Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really, really happy to have Chris Smith with me. Chris has had a career spanning law, technology, private equity, angel investing, and venture capital, and is now managing partner at Playfair Capital, a single LP, sector agnostic, early stage VC fund investing at pre-seed and seed in entrepreneurs building technology companies that rethink the way we live and work. Hey, Chris, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me on, Arish.
Absolute pleasure. So let's dive right in and start off with a little bit more about your background, because you've spent quite a bit of time in law, including firms like Olswang. How did you transition first into operating at Plan.com and then into investing?
Yeah, so I spent far too long in law. Let's just be clear about that. So it ended up being about 10 years in the end. I'd planned to do it for a few years and find something more interesting, but the financial crisis got in the way and had other ideas. So I guess the first step out of law was a very lucky day sitting in my office at Olswang, and I saw a job ad for an investment manager to join a firm called Brandon Investments. Pretty unusual to see an advert like that targeted at lawyers, so I thought this is amazing, I better apply. I found out subsequently it was actually only online for about 16 hours, so it really was one of those kind of serendipitous things that I just happened to see it at the right time. So applied for that job. Originally, it was one in London, one in the Isle of Man. I was obviously like, I'll have the one in London. Did a couple of interviews with the guy there, Dan Craddock, who runs the family office. And at the last minute, he said, oh, by the way, it's just in the Isle of Man. And I thought, well, I'm leaving law. Everyone thinks I'm crazy doing that. So I may as well go full crazy and move to this tiny rock in the middle of the Irish Sea. So I did that, joined Brandon Investments, and it ended up being actually a little different from what I expected. So it wasn't actually an investment management role. It became an operational one. So I worked for a B2B telecoms business called Plan.com pretty much from the first day. I think technically I was employee number 8, and I had a really amazing 4.5 years there. So 2 years as sales director, building and scaling a field and desk-based sales team, which by the way, I'd never done before. So it was literally just being thrown in the deep end. 3 months of abject failure and wondering what on earth I'd done, followed by a really happy, actually, 18 months of just loving running a sales team, working with the people. It was amazing. And then I moved across, once we found a full-time sales director to take over, moved over to the software development and data science team and kind of repeated the experience. No idea what I was doing. Had to really get stuck in. And so ended up there having a team of about 20 people, outsourced a major project where we rebuilt basically the core of our rating and billing engine to a firm out in Belarus. And I guess I got to the point where there were a few things that drove me to Playfair, actually. So the first one was just the learning curve had started to flatten a little bit. It'd been an amazing 4 years, but, you know, was there a huge amount more to learn? And there's a girl involved, you know, as there always is. So I met a girl on the Isle of Man who's now my wife, and she was moving back to the UK. So I think those couple of things just combined. And another serendipitous moment, I was reading John Gannon's blog. Massive shout out to John. And there was a job ad with this firm, Playfair Capital, in London for a partner. And I thought, that's unusual. Read the job description and thought, okay, that sounds amazing. And actually, I did apply, but I also got Ben Caulfield from ED, so one of my angel investments, to introduce me to, at the time, Georgia, who was the managing partner. And it kind of went from there. I had a call with Joe, who's now my partner here. Actually crouched down in a car park in the Isle of Man, both to hide from my colleagues and the wind as well. We just struck it off from that first call. And we then spent sort of 3 months together looking at deals, diligencing deals, and just figuring out, you know, whether we liked the way, I guess, we worked with each other, and eventually offered me a job in November 2018.
Amazing. For those that don't know, John Gannon's newsletter is VC Careers. It's a great newsletter, contains a huge amount of knowledge around how to enter venture capital, but equally job openings and postings that are currently going. And really interesting, I didn't realize you knew Ben. So I met Ben when he first joined ED, or Mass Doctor as it was at the time, back when it was in Founders Factory in 2016, I guess he would have probably come in. What an amazing operator. I must actually reach out to him and get him on this pod, because he's got some stories I'm pretty sure that he would love to share. So your transition to Playfair is really interesting, but you'd also been an angel investor with some pretty great ventures in your portfolio, including exits like Super Awesome and Bidstack. It feels like there's quite a difference between angel investing and venture. I know a lot of our listeners sort of maybe dabbling in one or either, but maybe not in both. And often it's an in terms of the proximity to the portfolio. So how do you look at it? Did being an angel help you as a VC, or did you have to unlearn some things? And I'm also sort of thinking about the fact that Playfair has actually a fairly unique structure in terms of VC, because it is a single LP VC fund, which, you know, Federico, the founder, was an angel before he set up in it, and it was one of the driving motivations for setting it up.
Yeah, I think so. Both, yeah, Fede, myself, and actually, so Henrik, our principal, he did a lot of crowdfunding when he was at university before he joined us. And then Simon, the chair of RSC, has been effectively a professional full-time angel investor for the past 20 years. So actually runs pretty deep here. I think it's a great grounding, because you become an angel investor because you love investing. You fall in love with companies. You have an emotional connection with the founders. You become really passionate about the mission. Obviously, it's incredibly, or normally for me at least, it was a very generalist approach. It was just like what looks interesting. And, you know, my first investment was actually a burrito business in London called Rapidar. I soon learned that investing in food and beverage was not where I wanted to be, and everything else since that has been in tech. But you kind of just follow your nose, and you make connections, you meet people. It's just a really fun way of sort of spending time and investing. So to me, it's almost the purest way of investing. And I think, you know, moving to Playfair, I'm still doing a lot of what I did as an angel. So I'm still looking for missions and founders that excite me, that I'm passionate about, and people that I really sort of click with and get on with. I think the main difference is that I still trust my gut. And I think my gut's sort of been a little bit refined over the years. Obviously, I've lost money as an angel, I've made money as an angel, so you kind of calibrate that pattern recognition. I still trust my gut, but I think it's what happens after that gut says yes, this is a good deal, that is so different. So, you know, we have a really deep diligence process. I mean, it's quick, but we end up writing 20-30 page investment memos, and recently a few people have been surprised at that. And I kind of explain it as, first of all, it makes, hopefully we make good decisions off the back of them, but also it helps us post-investment to really understand and know that company so that we can actually sort of start adding value straight away. So certainly that diligence piece is very different. And then obviously the amount you can actually do for the company. So when I was an angel, I used to try and help companies with a few introductions. Obviously, I'd be like an evangelist, a champion. I'd be sort of posting about them on social media and stuff. But, you know, now I've got a whole team of resources to put around that company, which is a significant difference as well.
So just sort of diving a little bit deeper into angel investing, there's a lot of stuff been going on recently around smaller check investing. What are your thoughts around check size for an angel? And it's something that I'm definitely very passionate about, because, you know, as someone who's operating, has founded a couple of businesses, you know, my capital's tight. I have limited sort of ability to throw cash around, but I think I can add value, and I certainly want to be involved in ventures. So for you, what are your thoughts around how big a check is big enough, or is any check good enough, especially depending on who's kind of putting that check in?
Yeah, so things have changed a lot. When I was angel investing, I started around 2008, even $25,000, £25,000 was on the small side. And like you say, you know, angel investors generally, especially when you're getting started, are capital constrained. So, you know, I have lots of things that you're probably not meant to, like, you know, borrowing on 0% credit cards to fund angel investing. Yeah, by the way, definitely don't do that. Yeah, I think the market now is much more open. So I think the idea that you can invest from, well, a few hundred pounds if it's crowdfunding, and then, you know, maybe £5,000 if it's angel investing, that's all positive. I think the main thing angel investors need to figure out is, you know, what value really are they adding to the company? I think you see it with VCs, you certainly see it with angels, that they purport to add value, but actually it doesn't translate, you know, post-investment. So check size, yeah, fine. I think small is great, but really figure out what your value add is.
The famous how can I help, right? So you've also been a Kaufman fellow. So what lessons do you think you learned as a Kaufman fellow that you might have missed had you not been accepted to the program? And how has it evolved your thinking as an investor?
Yeah, look, I mean, Kaufman fellows has been amazing. There's a bit of history there because Fede, our founder and chair, he did class 19. So I was sort of following in his footsteps there. No, I think what it mainly brings is a real US perspective on this. I think in Europe, there's a few things that we can do better. So the most obvious one is just generally thinking bigger. And that sort of is, we shouldn't just be building B2B SaaS companies and selling them for 50, 100 million. And I know that's like an old refrain, but I still think it's true that, you know, founders should really be shooting from the start. So I think that approach has been really clear from spending time with the Kaufman fellows. I think the second thing actually is around just the power of network. And the Call from Fellows network is very powerful, but it's made me think a lot about the flip side of that. So if you're outside the network, and, you know, one of the reasons that we started Female Founder Office Hours, one of the reasons that we have a open pitch form on our website, all to do with this fact that if you're in the network, it's great, but if you're not, life is more difficult, and it really shouldn't be that way. So we're always thinking about ways of making it easier for people to get access. And I think the third thing is, it's maybe a slight personal bias, but I love B2B, and I also like, it's not really deep tech, but it's like defensible technology, stuff that's going to give you a sort of sustainable advantage, at least over a few years. I've started to think more broadly about what I invest in. I think often in the US, people are a bit more open. They're happy to look stuff that is just a pure execution play because the founders are brilliant or because they have particular insights. So definitely just trying to widen that lens a little bit. And it's definitely something that the team here, you know, particularly Henrik and Jeevan and Andrew, are encouraging because they want to push the boundaries. You know, they want to do a bit more consumer. They want to do things that are a bit more exciting. So that's been eye-opening as well.
Yeah, I think there's a definite perception, let's say, that Europe is slightly more private equity leaning than venture, like in its truest sense. And to your point, you know, investing at the earlier stages, pre-product, often, you know, idea stage is something that not many VCs in UK and Europe necessarily do. Equally, I think there is this, not rejection, but this difficulty with consumer and brands, because again, the addressable market in either the UK or in Europe, when you start thinking about localization and, you know, how do you approach each of those different markets versus obviously a very large, not necessarily homogenous market like the US, but a market that certainly, you know, has the same language, has relatively similar cultural norms and experiences, etc. I think I completely get that. And I think here in Europe, maybe it is about moving away from that paradigm of B2B, whether it's SaaS or otherwise, but thinking beyond traditional kind of software businesses and looking at those that are slightly more groundbreaking. I think that perspective is definitely something I would welcome seeing more of. And there are a lot of US VCs now coming over this side of the pond to start deploying because they're seeing, you know, valuations that aren't quite reaching the heady heights that they are in the US. So talking further about Playfair, so it's a single LP fund. What impact or benefit do you think that that has on your agility and ability to make or close deals, especially having just told me that you write 30-page investment memorandums?
Yeah, by the way, this happened really quickly. So I think I wrote one over a weekend, and I think Henrik wrote one in 24 hours. So it definitely doesn't slow us down. Yeah, no, I think being a single LP fund does a few things. So it definitely means that we're not sort of, we don't have a strict investment mandate. So we can break our rules. It means we can flex looking at different sectors, or even like tweaking our check size a little bit, and obviously just ultimately make quick decisions. But honestly, do I think that's a competitive advantage? Maybe a tiny bit, but this market moves so quickly that we're seeing traditional funds with tons of LPs, you know, make decisions over sort of 2 or 3 days. So I actually think where it has the most impact is post-investment. So most investors spend, call it, half their life focused on their LPs. Whether it's actually raising the fund in the first place, whether it is reporting to those LPs, or just thinking about keeping them happy and keep, you know, what they want. We don't have to do that. I mean, obviously we have to keep fairly happy, but it's a very different process. And so we spend 100% of our time with our founders. And so when we spend strategy days with them, you know, full days really diving deep into something, or we're doing weekly coaching sessions with them, or helping them with hiring, and, you know, Joe's getting involved to hire the first 10, you know, key people after a fundraise. That's all because we love doing it, but it's also because we have the time to do it. And so I really think that's where it has the most impact.
Not only the time, but you come from operating background as well. I mean, it was actually interesting, just going back to something you said right at the beginning, you know, the process that you went through when you moved to the Isle of Man. You went in, you solved with a complete generalist background. So you're a lawyer, went in with a generalist background, looked at the problem, solved the problems, and then set up a process to replicate. And I think that's fundamentally the thing that all startup operators and certainly founders need to get very good at very quickly. I often say that some of the best operators or founders in any particular vertical, whether that's edtech, fintech, or health tech, or anything else, often are very good because they come in with a naivety. So the best are often from outside of the vertical because they don't come in with the preconceptions. I mean, obviously they lack potentially some of that experience or knowledge base, but it allows them to view stuff with a completely fresh set of eyes and not kind of get tied down by the previous paradigm. So I think being able to lend that lens to your cohorts and your portfolio co's, obviously, you know, is massively powerful. So talking about where you invest, how you invest, what stage. So it'd be great to understand what stages you invest at. And from a Playfair perspective, you know, you just talked about being quite generalist, but what does there have to be for you to invest in them? Is it the team? Is it the traction? Is it the tech that they've built? Is it the market? Is it something else?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, look, we sit in the pre-seed or early seed, and I know that these definitions keep moving all the time at the moment. So let's just say anything up from 100K up to a 600K check in the first round, although we are potentially tweaking that a little bit higher, round sizes of, well, anything from 500K up to about 3 million. And then, of course, we do follow on quite aggressively. So, you know, if we put 600K in the first round, a million, million and a half in the Series A is kind of the model that we're working with. And then what do we look for? I mean, it's hard not to be cliched here, but I'll try and avoid it. So yeah, team. We're looking for world-class people, the best people to do whatever mission that they've decided to dedicate their next 5 to 10 years to. And, you know, some of that they've studied something or they've been in a previous role, but actually most of it is just about character. It's about all these indefinable things that you pick up, you know, as you meet and engage. I would say coachability is extremely high, though. And we've seen it recently, I think, because founders are in a great position to raise capital. We have seen founders come to us and essentially say, look, I've got two term sheets. Do you want to chuck your hat in the ring? And the answer is, well, what do you want from us? Is there going to be a two-way relationship? And if the founder's not interested, it doesn't tend to work particularly well. So that kind of coachability, wanting support, being open to ideas is really important. Obviously the market, just big, growing ideally, but if the whole market's not growing, maybe some sub-segment within it that's interesting. And I'd say everything else is less important. I mean, if they've built a product, then signs of really, again, world-class execution, avoiding the bad stuff like typos and mistakes and things like that is quite important as well, because we're just trying to extrapolate what's already been done. So again, if it's an app and we see bad reviews on the app store that haven't been addressed, that's not great, right? We're going to extrapolate that and assume that there's some challenge there. But I think above all, not above the team, but probably above everything else, we need to be passionate about the mission and about what the founders are doing. So, you know, we're not an impact fund, but it's no coincidence that the things we've invested in, to us, have the potential to somehow change the world, probably for the better, but at least make a really big impact in their market. So definitely like being aligned on that passion. And we tend to only know that once we've met the founders. And then also just companies where we think we can help. Of course, we'd make an investment if the founder knows they can just do everything and they don't need us. But in general, we immediately have this meeting of minds of, well, we can definitely help you with structuring your sales team or your commission structures or whatever it is, or your go to market, or we can really help you on the talent side with hiring your first people.
Yeah, I think that ability, what you called coachability, the ability to listen, is a trait that more and more with the founders I work with, those that I've invested in, I look at as a really important factor, because it tells you whether they are going to just be doggedly chasing their tail even when things are not going well, or whether they will at the very least open their ears, listen, assess. And then whether or not they then kind of, you know, take forward that advice is a different matter. But it's just the ability to even absorb what has been suggested, I think, is massively important. And we all know that within startup life, you're going to be pivoting, you know, more often than not often, right? So I would heavily kind of endorse that characterization of coachability and that ability to listen as being massively important. And in fact, flipping the question around, I guess, right? So that's what you invest in, but why do startups come to you? You recently set up the Founders Studio. You know, we've talked about that a little bit, but why do you think that's, what is it for a start for our listeners? Why do you think that's important? And especially at the moment, what impact do you hope it'll have on your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so at the Founder Studio, we've got a 3-story building here in Clerkenwell, and the Founder Studio is a complete floor of that building, set up as a large boardroom, which fits probably about 14, 16 people, a small sort of meeting room of four, and then some hot desking space and a like sofa kind of chill out area. And, you know, I think the reason we did it was we just recognized the challenge the pandemic's thrown up. And, you know, I think about how we operate at Playfair, and yes, we got through the pandemic and we still made investments, and those investments are doing fine. It probably actually hasn't altered that much, but we weren't actually having that much fun because we didn't spend much time together. And particularly for the new joiners to the team, it was quite difficult to get that cultural alignment, like to really understand how we do things and think about things. And obviously the sort of more junior people in the team, miss the opportunity to sort of learn by osmosis, right? Just to hear things that are going on and also to surface issues they want to talk about. There's this kind of threshold when you're remote that it has to be like fairly important to warrant jumping on a call, as opposed to something in the office, which can just be like a casual, oh, by the way, something happened. What do you think? And I think the same applied to our companies. So pretty much when the pandemic hit, all of them gave up their office space, but they started to talk to us about, you know, what do you think going forward? And we said, well, it's kind of up to you. Some of you are going to be fully remote forever. That's fine. Some of you are going to do hybrid. Maybe some of you will come back full time, but I kind of doubt it. And so we offered them the space back in April, kind of did like a beta launch to just see how it went. And it got booked up immediately for 4 months solid. We thought, right, okay, there's something here. And what the founders are generally doing is holding team or like collab days, either a sort of weekly, bi-weekly, monthly cadence to them. Yeah, and they're using it to kind of build social bonds, to ensure this kind of cultural alignment, basically just to check everyone's doing okay, and to do a bit of morale building around it. So they might come in for the day and, you know, go for dinner afterwards or go to the pub afterwards. And, you know, one reason it's actually really important is the hiring market is so hot. So, you know, if you're a startup and you're going to have people trying to poach your team, you know, from the big tech companies, from, you know, startups or scale ups a little bit further on than you that can pay more. So, you know, actually keeping people engaged, keeping people like on mission is just really important. And I think so far it's worked. Like the feedback from founders has been great. I think they are feeling that more, that sense of collaboration and teamwork and working together.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm holding my first on-site this week. Very small team, but first time we're all meeting in person. We've got two relatively kind of junior hires that came in just this last month. So for me, it's a massively important day. We're not going to go into anything massively heavy in terms of the business or what the business is doing, but it is, to your point, it's about retaining them. It's about making sure that they feel like they're part of a team and it's not this abstract thing that sits on Zoom or on Slack and that's the only time or the only place that they get to see and hear us. I think it's massively important. Being a people person myself, I mean, I'm a linguist by background, you know, that communication channel, that in-person communication channel is going to become even more important because it is less frequent. And I think therefore having very, very good quality opportunities to meet and talk and that equally means the places that you meet and talk, I think, is a massive value add for team members. And, you know, two of these team members are coming in from, you know, outside of London, a good 2 to 3 hours away. So it's even more important, therefore, that you have those places and, you know, that really sort of strong cultural element to those conversations, because otherwise you run the risk of either losing them or finding it hard to recruit people down the track. So just before we close off, like venture seems to be going through a bit of an exuberant phase at the moment. I think that's probably the best way I can put it. A lot of capital to deploy and a plethora of businesses trying to raise capital. How do you see this playing out over the coming years? And has it made things harder or easier in your opinion? You talked a bit earlier about the speed at which things are happening right now. It'd be great to get a little bit more color on that.
What a question, right? To wrap up with, what's going to happen? Look, it definitely exuberant is the right word. I think one thing that's worth pointing out from my perspective is that actually a lot of the exuberance is happening late seed or Series A onwards. So I think a lot of founders listening who, you know, aren't raising their money in a week probably get a little bit frustrated and feel like, you know, they're doing something wrong. You know, actually a pre-seed and seed, it's still really tough to raise money. You know, yes, it's better than it was, but actually it hasn't changed that much. That's one thing I'd say. Definitely don't get disheartened if it's still taking a reasonable amount of time at those earlier stages. I mean, I guess more broadly, everything points to a correction. I'm not an economist. I was a lawyer, as you know, but, you know, inflation looks like it's becoming an issue. We have had IPOs being pulled recently, but venture has this like long lag time because obviously the funds have been raised. People are sitting on even bigger funds and they're going to have to be deployed. So I guess it's probably as much a hope. It's actually definitely a hope rather than a prediction, is that things will effectively stabilize. Things can't keep going up, that's for sure. But I definitely like and buy into the idea that we'll have some kind of stabilization, maybe a slight correction, but in venture, it shouldn't be too painful, you know, particularly given this sort of macro trend of what's happening in tech. You know, tech is definitely disrupting every facet of our life. So I'll probably regret that. I was a bit optimistic there, but let's see what happens. And then I think for founders in general, it's making life a little bit easier, and hopefully it'll still be a really buoyant funding environment for them for the coming months and years. My one caution there is that just because it's easier in most cases to raise capital, you still got to choose the right fund. And I wrote a piece about sort of buyer's remorse. I think that's a really real issue now. Rounds move so quickly that founders can get really almost trapped by the speed of things, and that's obviously not a good thing. And then for VCs, I think honestly, pre-seed and seed, maybe bigger funds starting to come down the capital structure a little bit is a challenge. But in general, it's positive. Like you mentioned US funds coming in earlier. We're happy. We want more expertise. We want more capital in the ecosystem. I think if I was a Series A, Series B fund, life is a little challenging right now. And I think you have to really figure out what your value add is versus the really huge, you know, multi-stage funds like the Tigers of this world coming in. But look, from a Playfair perspective, I'm super positive. I think there's still loads of opportunities for us to invest in new investments. And it's a really good environment at the moment for our existing portfolio companies to raise follow-on as well.
I think venture without optimism would not be venture. So I think you are bang on the money to keep that optimism going. And I think for all of us in the ecosystem, it's a great time to be building. It's a great time to be deploying. It's a great time to be involved. And certainly I tell all the lawyers and doctors that I know, you know, 20 years on, still having buyer's remorse for that degree, that maybe it's time that they jump ship and thought about joining a startup. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here with me today. Thank you so much for joining me. Where can our listeners find you? You're on LinkedIn, you're on Twitter. Where's the best place to look for you?
Yeah, LinkedIn, Twitter. I write for Forbes less often than I probably should or would like to. But yeah, I mean, look, if you hit the Playfair Capital website, you'll find me there.
Amazing. Chris, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks very much, Irish.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?